This is Joanne Silberner. When it comes to her new baby, 37-year-old Elise Vandermeer of Atlanta feels like most parents.
She's the love of my life, and I would do absolutely anything, anything to protect her.
Look, Lena.
And when Lena Rose was born 7 months ago, Elise had a decision to make about her healthy baby. Should she immunize her?
I'm a little intimidated by the schedule. There are 24 shots scheduled in a two-year period, and that is not including the flu shot. So it is a concern.
A survey 10 years ago showed that a quarter of parents were concerned that vaccines might be too much for a baby's immune system. But when you look at the biology, it seems less daunting. Even fetuses have immune system cells, as early as 14 weeks gestation. Edgar Marcuse, professor of pediatrics at the University of Washington, says one part of the immune system takes a little longer to kick in, but babies are born pretty much ready to go.
The infant immune system can respond to most everything. As soon as they're born, they are bombarded with all the things that exist in our world.
He and some colleagues once calculated giving 11 vaccines all at one time, which no one does, would use up only 0.1% of the capacity of a baby's immune system, and even that would quickly regenerate. Still, Elise Vandermeer wondered if she should at least space out the vaccines. So she talked to Lena Rose's pediatrician.
My doctor was actually very open. He said, you know, she's your baby. We'll do whatever you want. We'll be flexible. But he did advise me against it for two reasons.
First, the number of office visits needed to give the shots one at a time. Edgar Marcuse explains reason two.
When you space out the vaccines, you leave your infant susceptible to diseases you could otherwise have prevented, particularly when they're most at risk in the first 6 or 8 months of life.
Babies can get whooping cough, they can get meningitis, and these diseases can be very serious. But what about all those foreign substances going into babies' bodies, the viruses and bacteria, or, more precisely, the parts of them that are used to make vaccines? Well, vaccines now are cleaner than they used to be, says Saad Omer of Emory University. He studies parents' concerns about immunizations.
A lot of people say that the number of vaccines has gone up. Actually, the number of antigens, which is the active part of a vaccine, hasn't gone up. It has gone down in the U.S. population.
An antigen is a part of a virus or bacterium used in a vaccine. The 5 injections given to kids back in 1980 contained a total of about 3,000 different antigens. 20 years later, there were 15 more injections, and the total number of antigens was down to about 125, from 3,000 to 125. Another thing missing from childhood vaccines that some parents worried could hurt their babies is a preservative called thimerosal that contains mercury. Omer says one thing a lot of parents today don't realize, getting exposed to childhood infections is far worse than getting the vaccines. Take measles. Here's what that disease did to kids before there was a vaccine.
So what the study shows that 1 in 1,000 kids who got measles, so measles infection, had brain damage or an illness related to that. And 1 in 500 kids had a risk of dying in this country. This is not data from, let's say, Nigeria or Bangladesh.
The risk from getting the measles vaccine is a 1 in 1,000,000 chance of some brain damage. And deaths, the risk is too low to even calculate. Both Omer and Marcuse say understanding the risks and benefits of vaccines is a lot of information for new parents. Elise Vandermeer talked with friends, with her doctors. She read up as much as she could, and she's going ahead with Lena Rose's vaccines on schedule. But Elise admits even though she knows it's the best thing to do, she says a few Hail Marys each time. Joanne Silberner, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We're going to talk about vaccines this morning in your health. We're going to look at the shot schedule for kids who may now get 24 shots before the age of 2.
But first, we go to vaccines that are not just for kids. A new report finds that many adults over 65 who should be immunized against pneumonia are not. NPR's Patty Naiman takes a look at how vaccines work and how they can be made more effective in older people.
It's not just getting older adults immunized that's a challenge. When they do get their shots, they're not as fully protected as younger people. To see why, it's helpful to understand just how the immune system of a younger adult responds to a vaccine. What they're getting is a shot made up of little pieces of the germ, the invader, that causes the disease.
And pieces of bacteria are foreign and pieces of viruses are foreign.
So then, says Dr. Stefan Gravenstein of Brown University, your immune system goes into action when it gets a vaccine.
The body then sends cells to that site, recognizing that this is something foreign.
But is it friend or foe? Gravenstein says these immune system cells know just how to figure that out, and then they start to fight back. The first thing they need? More troops.
They develop a way to make copies of themselves that can also recognize that same foreign thing. And they make lots of copies and then get spread throughout the body. So now you have a refined surveillance system for the whole body.
Like microscopic spies searching the bloodstream for enemies, some of these spying cells also begin to make antibodies, which are like little flags that literally attach themselves to the foreign invader, alerting the rest of the immune system to their exact location. And that's when the killer cells go into action. Some of them work like this.
When they get close to that virus, they have things called perforins that perforate the surface of the virus, the membrane, that then allow it to leak out its contents.
Punching holes in the invading organism and bursting it apart. Other killer cells absorb the remains of the foreign invader and use their enzymes to chew it up. So a vaccine trains the immune system to build up a defense and be ready for battle against a real virus or bacteria. But somewhere between your 50s and 70s, your whole immune reaction, you could say, just sort of loses its pep. When confronted with a vaccine or a real germ, the immune system of an older person makes less of everything. Fewer spy cells, fewer antibodies, and fewer killer cells.
Now, it doesn't need to be that depressing because we can change the environment and these cells work much better.
Using workarounds that can sort of trick the older immune system into behaving like a young one. Gravenstein says scientists are investigating chemicals that can be added to vaccines to stimulate the immune system to produce more antibodies and more killer cells. And vaccines can be given in bigger doses. Infectious disease specialist Anne Falsey of the University of Rochester in New York headed a study of 4,000 people over 65. One-third got a standard flu vaccine. Two-thirds received a vaccine that was four times the usual dose.
The group who received the high-dose vaccine had a significantly better antibody response, about twice as good as the group who got the usual vaccine.
With minimal side effects.
A little bit more in the way of a sore arm, a little more redness, and a little more swelling. But generally, it was quite well tolerated.
The FDA recently approved a new high-dose flu vaccine for older Americans. And there's one final strategy to better protect older Americans, according to Dr. Ken Schmader, chief of geriatrics at Duke University Medical Center.
When children are immunized against things like influenza and pneumococcal disease, it appears to help protect older adults as well. As children have gotten the new pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, for instance, and that's been since the year 2000, serious pneumococcal infections have declined in older adults.
And Schmader says healthcare workers who are around older adults should also be vaccinated. That's a group who have resisted mandatory vaccinations in the past. Patty Naiman, NPR News.
Online relationship rules are still being written, but there's one rule that has made an easy transition from the analog to the digital world: sex sells.
As we continue our pre-Valentine's Day All Tech Considered, we're going to hear now about a romantic comedy that never made it to the big screen,
but it has been watched by millions on desktops and laptops.
Okay, you understand. We don't want boyfriends. We don't want boyfriends. We don't want relationships. We want two guys to service us. This is strictly sexual.
The name of the film is Strictly Sexual. It's about two working professional women who've given up on relationships and decide to employ a couple of gigolos to fill the void.
Really, the movie is about love and intimacy. And if I were to title the film Love and Intimacy, I'm sure people would think it was pretentious and never watch it.
Director Stevie Long adds that it's not a porn flick. In fact, there's no nudity in his film whatsoever.
Yet Strictly Sexual is the most watched movie of all time on Hulu.com. No stars are in it, and even though it never had a theatrical release, Long got it into the hands of a company that distributes films on cable and the internet.
I woke up one morning and found a dozen or so messages in my Facebook inbox, you know, saying, hey, I just saw this film and, you know, it really touched me and I love the way it talks about breakups and relationships. And I just kind of scratched my head saying, where'd you see my movie? You know, I had no idea actually what Hulu was. God bless, you know, the people who had the foresight to put it up there.
Hulu, for those who still don't know, is an incredibly popular video streaming website. One online measurement service, ComScore, reported that more than a billion videos were watched on Hulu in December 2009 alone.
It carries some movies and a lot of popular television shows, Lost, The Office, Family Guy. Long figures that people stumbled upon his film on Hulu while catching up on their favorite TV shows.
We were hoping, you know, in a perfect world that, you know, it would open on 2,000 screens, that, you know, a Harvey Weinstein would put it all across America. We were fortunate in that the timing of the internet and the ability for people to watch movies came about at the same time. I didn't have an ego about it. As an artist, I just wanted my movie to be seen.
Hulu won't provide an exact view count for Strictly Sexual, but there are enough people watching to make Stevie Long a profit through commercials embedded with the movie.
I'll give it to you in these rough terms. The film, the $100,000 film, has made 10 times its money.
Enough to fund Long's next independent film.
It's a tragic tale. It's about people in the porn industry and the denial that goes on there. We've appropriately titled it Porn Star, The Ugly Life of a Beautiful Girl. And I'd like to think a lot of people are going to click on that title.
Whether they click on it or not, Long has already proven that the internet is a place where independent filmmakers can thrive.
If the title is right. Don't forget to go to our All Tech Considered blog, where you'll find quirky tech stories you can't help but read.
That's npr.org/alltech. This is NPR News.
Of all the political scandals involving infidelity in high places, John Edwards, Elliot Spitzer, James McGreevy, one stands out, not for what the politician did, but for what the politician's wife did not do. Jenny Sanford did not stand by her man in the glare of lights and cameras, as he, South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford, confessed.
So the bottom line is this. I've been unfaithful to my wife. I developed a relationship with what started as a dear, dear friend from Argentina.
That affair and his rambling, tearful description of it ended Mark Sanford's star turn as the Republicans' most resolute fiscal conservative. Now, Jenny Sanford has written about what led up to this moment in a new memoir, Staying True. And she joined us from Charleston to talk about it. Thanks very much for joining us.
Glad to be here, Renee.
You know, I just wondered, is that still hard for you to listen to?
You know, in some respects, yes. The whole saga has been somewhat surreal. But it's, you know, it becomes like all things in life. It becomes part of who you are, I guess. So it's probably not the last time I'll hear that press conference again.
Well, remind listeners, if you would, Governor Sanford, Mark Sanford, arrived at this press conference just after getting off a plane from Argentina after being caught in a lie about having been hiking on the Appalachian Trail.
Right. Well, he told his staff, apparently, that he was going to hike on the Appalachian Trail. But I was aware already that he had been having an affair, and I basically asked him to leave the house. And that did not include permission to see his lover. So when I heard that he was supposedly on the Appalachian Trail, frankly, I was hopeful that's where he was. And I was hopeful that he was alone. But I had plenty of reason to doubt.
You did not stand stoically and supportively next to your disgraced husband. Why not?
Well, a couple of reasons. One, he didn't ask me, but if he had asked me, I would have said no. too, well, we were separated. I don't know what I would have stood by him about. He had been physically in Argentina. I had not really had contact with him until that morning when he was on his way back. There were a lot of surrounding factors.
You did watch it on television. Mm-hmm. How did you even manage to get through it? Because, you know, it didn't have to be this way, but it was over the top.
Mm-hmm. I felt very strongly that not only did I need to watch the press conference, but, I mean, I even, you know, asked one of my girlfriends, shh, I said, you have to be quiet. I felt like I needed to hear every word in some respects because I really felt the need to make a statement afterwards, not a soundbite, but really to let the world know where I was coming from.
What you said in your statement was very well received.
You know, it was very honest and very from the heart, speaking about things that mattered to me, marriage, family. I quoted from the Bible. You know, I asked for people to respect our privacy while I did my best to heal our family.
In the book, we find that your husband, after he finished his press conference, he called you up, and his question at that time was, how'd I do?
Yeah, how'd I do? Oh, gosh, I just, you know, talk about another gut punch. How'd you do? I said, gee whiz. You know, he saw me as an advisor, you know, wanted me to give him a political advice about how he was received.
What exactly did you say to him?
I think I said, are you kidding? You know, cried for your lover and said very little of me or the boys. You know, from a wife's perspective, no, he did not say what I wished he had said. And frankly, from a political perspective, he talked way too long. So, you know, if I were to have responded with my political hat or my spouse hat or my Christian hat or my mom hat, I mean, you know, I would have given him a poor grade on all counts.
Really reading that, though, there was a stunning disconnect between who he was speaking to, that is you, his wife, who right. He's betrayed, and what he's asking you to comment on. And I just wonder if that's part of a disconnect that you describe that seem to be exacerbated when he went into politics.
There's no question. You know, Mark is, he's a guy that has a very kind demeanor. He's very soft-spoken. He's got a kind of a gentle spirit. He's somebody that I thought had very solid values, biblically based and strong moral guiding principle. And yet there's just no question whatsoever. I can trace back the unraveling of our marriage really began when he became a congressman. And he ran what I can only describe as an incredibly principled campaign based on the ideas. You know, he did things that no modern day politicians do. He had a 30-page paper on why we needed to privatize Social Security, for example. And the strength I think it took over the years for him to stick to his political principles went hand in hand with the stroking of the ego that comes with people in high political office and the disconnect that comes from being placed immediately in a transformational way, just, you know, overnight into an office where everybody wants access to you, not because you're a different person, but just because of the position you hold. And that's a, you know, it's a tough load to carry, and it becomes that much more important that you remain grounded in your values. And over time, it becomes clear to me today that he lost sight of those and became disconnected from the person that he originally was.
He has a very, and you say this, you know, a strong sense of right and wrong, black and white, as you put it, to the point where instead of renting an apartment, he ended up like sleeping in his congressional office on a futon.
And now the guy he's notorious for that. And I mean, there was nothing in his day-to-day life that led me to believe that he was crumbling from a values perspective in another area of his life. Because in his public life, everything he did was to a T exactly true to what he had originally campaigned on. And true to really the guy he is. It's the guy that can pinch a penny better than anybody I know. And, you know, I mean, to his core. And so he lived it in all aspects of his campaign, all aspects of his political life.
There's a story you tell about you got, as a birthday gift, a promise of half a bicycle.
Oh, yeah, I still have that card. He drew a card that has it had a picture of like a man with balloons or something on the front. And then inside there was a half a bike. I didn't quite understand it. I said, no, what does this mean? And he said, well, it's just half a bike and I'll get you the other half for Christmas or something. And then I got another picture with half a bike for Christmas. And then he delivered the bike. It wasn't even a new bike. It was a $25 used purple bike. Now, was it really important to me that I get a new bike versus a full bike versus a half a bike? No, at the end of the day, if I understood that this is who he was and he did it in a sweet way, it was a cute little card and a note. I mean, you know, it didn't offend me. So because I grew to understand how deeply seated that frugality was in his psyche.
You have filed for divorce. I think a lot of people would want to know, and if you don't mind my asking, what is your relationship to Mark Sanford, your husband, right now?
You know what? One of our boys just had a birthday, and Mark and I together took the boys out for dinner, and we had a delightful time, and we went back to the house and had birthday cake and opened presents, and then he drove back to Columbia. So you know what? We're getting along beautifully, which is a choice on both of our parts. We are committed to being as compatible as we can be for the sake of our children.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Renee.
Jenny Sanford is South Carolina's first lady. Her memoir on her marriage to Governor Sanford is called Staying True.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. $45 billion. That's how much Shanghai has spent on a facelift ahead of the World Expo this May. It's an even higher price tag than the seemingly extravagant Beijing Olympics. The makeover includes 6 new subway lines, a riverside promenade, and a coat of paint for just about every neighborhood. But as NPR's Louisa Lim reports from Shanghai, more and more people are asking one simple question: is it worth it?
A burst of firecrackers celebrates the opening of the Expo Boulevard. On this site, 192 countries and 50 organizations will take part in Shanghai's World Expo, building pavilions that will be open for 6 months, starting in May. This will be Shanghai's moment in the sun. And many, like Expo construction worker Miao Yonggan, can't wait.
The Shanghai Expo will be even better than the Olympics. It will win glory for the Chinese people all around the world.
The theme of World Expo 2010 Shanghai is Better City, Better Life.
Sustainability is one of the expo's themes. And back in August, the United Nations Environment Programme issued a report praising the expo's green legacy. But whispers of doubt are beginning to be heard. Richard Brubaker teaches a course on sustainability at China Europe International Business School. He says the expo, by its nature, is the very opposite of sustainable development.
You're building 55, 56 pavilions that are the country pavilions. And at the end of the 6 months, only the 4 China pavilions will remain. So 52 will be taken off, which would be, to many, a huge anti-sustainability campaign.
A team of his MBA students has spent 3 months trying to find out what will happen to the thousands of tons of steel, concrete and glass used in the pavilions. The short answer, MBA Liu Ming explains, is nobody knows.
Really, when we dig into the details of it, we are so surprised that, you know, if you look at individual pavilions, they don't really have a plan on how do they get rid of the material they are using in their temporary structures.
Local artists, too, are taking on the expo in an exhibition called Makeover, which focuses on Shanghai's transformation. I meet Chen Hanfeng standing beside his work, a bubble machine hooked up to an IV tube, belching bubbles into a cage. He's taken a sly poke at the expo slogan, Better City, Better Life, by titling his work, Bubble City, Bubble Life.
I think the concept of expo, it started from a utopia, you know, utopian-style architecture, futuristic imagination. I think it's kind of like a bubble.
And, I mean, what you're saying, you know, bubble pops and nothing is left.
After expo's gone, everything's going to be gone, right?
Another artist, Ji Wen Yu, is busily pasting 100 official propaganda slogans on top of each other. He calls his work The History of the People's Republic of China. The topmost slogan is Wonderful Expo, Civilization First. The world in front of you, we are by your side. He's conflicted about the expo. He likes the idea, but dislikes the destruction wrought on his city in the expo's name.
Before every big event, the authorities are always painting the walls and covering things up. China's history is very long, but every time something new happens, they just erase history. For example, even though I'm Shanghainese born and bred, nowadays I sometimes get lost in my own city.
This song, by a punk band called Top Floor Circus, also touches upon how expo-related demolitions are affecting young locals. It's a parody of the Beijing Olympic song, which was called Beijing Welcomes You. The lyrics here go, Shanghai doesn't welcome you unless you've come to buy something. The song claims the expo will bring only the world's rich people to Shanghai. Expo spokesman Xu Wei says that's not true.
It's not like that. Ordinary people can go. Last year, the tickets were discounted to $20 each. Objectively speaking, 9 out of every 10 Shanghainese is extremely concerned with the expo and really welcomes it. And for any individuals who are opposed to it, well, they're free to do that.
Expo, Shanghai, China. It's certainly true that the majority of Shanghainese do welcome the expo, but the voices of criticism are hardly free. In fact, they're being actively muzzled. That pop song has been deleted from the Chinese internet. And a local English language magazine was forced to tone down a story raising concerns about the expo because it was deemed too negative. Shanghai is determined that nobody will spoil its party. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Shanghai.
The novelist Don DeLillo writes of a man who's growing uncomfortable. Everything he sees reminds him of swiftly passing time.
A taxi meter, an appointment, a cell phone, all of that is a measurement of time that tends to make him anxious.
That man is a central character in the latest work by a leading American writer. In past novels, Don DeLillo reimagined John F. Kennedy's assassination, the Cold War, even 9/11. His new novel, called Point Omega, also seems to dwell on public events, though it centers on that one anxious man. Richard Elster flees alone to a house in the middle of the California desert. He flees because he feels the ticking of mortality.
Out in the desert, what he feels is so vast that it doesn't necessarily affect him personally.
Well, you present us with this gray-haired, sort of ponytailed university intellectual thinking really big thoughts in a really big place. And yet he's also remembering or recovering from a really specific recent news event.
You're referring to the war.
This is a man you describe as having been an intellectual who was brought into an administration to help plan what appears to be the Iraq War.
He was, he was part of a series of closed meetings in conference rooms. And what he was intended to contribute was a kind of overarching view, not of specific troop movements, but to give them a deeper idea of how to wage this particular kind of war. And it gives him something to be in retreat from, that is, his experience during those 2 years or so that he spent as a defense intellectual. And his retreat occurs in this desert terrain.
Mm-hmm. And you create a filmmaker who comes to see him, wants to get him to make a film, which, well, at one point, the main character, Elster, describes it as a confession. He basically says, "You want a confession from me."
This is what Jim Finley probably intends. He wants a man against the wall. He wants a man standing and talking. He wants a face on the screen. And if Elster decides to veer in his monologue from Iraq to any other subject, young Jim Finley is happy to film it. He believes that on film, the face is the soul. He calls it a primal film. And this is what he hopes Elster will agree to do.
What do you think draws you as a writer who's concerned with really large themes of time and life and death to focus on people who have some connection to public news events?
I think for decades now, we've been flooded by media stimulation of one kind or another. And once it becomes part of everybody's life, I think it becomes part of a fiction writer's conceivable subject, at least at some level. It has just seemed to me to be an important element in our lives. And I guess, in one sense, my work all these years has been about living in dangerous times. And part of this danger has been what the media reports and how it changes our perceptions.
I'm thinking of a novel of yours that must be more than a quarter century old now, White Noise. I still remember a passage from that book, which I relate to now as a parent, in that there's a father and a son. They're driving in a car. It's dumping down rain. The son says, you're smiling, I'm glad you remember this too. The son says, the radio says it's going to rain tonight. The father says it's raining now. The son says the radio said tonight. You have this conflict between reality and virtual reality.
Yeah, and the conflict is, I think, ever-present. It's something that we breathe in through our pores. It's just part of our perception.
Do you feel you have some of the same obsessions as you did many years ago when you were writing your early work?
I think I have the same obsessions. I'm not sure I could state them clearly. I think they involve danger and, to some extent, violence and people moving towards some sort of inevitability, perhaps.
Some sort of inevitability, meaning death, I suppose.
That's at the end of everything, yes. And I think that's ultimately what shapes my work and, in a sense, maybe what shapes most art.
Because you've written so much about death or people who seem in some way to be anxious about or fearing death, I wonder how your own thoughts on that subject have evolved as you yourself have grown older.
I'm still 22 in my mind. When I'm walking along a street, I'm not a novelist of a certain age. I'm just the same guy I always was. That's how I feel. I don't feel different. I'm not aware that I think different. I don't think about these matters in a very conscious way.
You don't think about them in a conscious way, and yet they keep coming out on the page.
Well, there it is. That's what writers do, I suppose. We do express ourselves, but we don't necessarily do it in the first person. We don't necessarily do it as autobiography. It simply flows out of us and into characters.
When I think about the work that you've done over the last many years, some of your characters have families, some do not. Some are deeply engaged in the world. In this case, you have a man who's withdrawn to the desert and gotten as disengaged from the world as he could. And yet, it seems to me that no matter what their circumstance, a great many of your main characters are basically lonely, if not alienated from the world.
I think this is probably true. And in some of them, in earlier novels, tend to be men in small rooms. And in Elster's case, it's a man in a vast desert. But essentially the same kind of situation.
What draws you to that alienation?
There's no simple answer to that question. It certainly isn't an autobiographical aspect of my fiction. But there's something about a single individual, isolated from the world, that appeals to me as a writer. Everything funneled into one man in one room. You know, it's not something I try to explain to myself. It's just a feeling, and it's something I'm driven toward.
Don DeLillo's new novel is called Point Omega. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Read a passage from Point Omega at npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.